Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm, and I'm really happy because my guest, Joshua Cohn, has written a new novel, and I'm the first person to talk to him about it. It's called Moving Kings, and, wow, it is a family novel, in a crazy sense, a family that keeps growing and assassinating each other and welcoming each other by saying, go to hell. The hero, to some extent, or at least the character we meet first, the most recognizable character to me is a guy named David King who owns a moving company. He worked his way up the way people do, you know, we work our way up. And so he started to own his own trucks. And when people couldn't move their objects into a house that's ready for the objects, he put them in storage. And when the people don't have money for the storage, he started to collect objects. So he has rooms of appliances, rooms of televisions. It's like a pawn shop that no one can ever retrieve their things from. And he has, you know, relatives who need televisions. Well, why not? I've got 50.
Yeah, come on over and come on over. Shop.
Yeah. 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 Tell me what you need. And it's really crazy because he wants, like an old-fashioned guy, to be a paterfamilias, the head of a family.
That's all he wants, yeah.
Yeah. And David King becomes, in some crazy sense, King David, or does he?
He does, as with the other characters of the story, all named after the story of David and Bathsheba.
Tell us that story. Give us the outline of it.
I decided to write the story really with the Bathsheba character in the background, but it's, you know, it's David who has blood on his hands. He's the warrior. He's the man who fought his way to the top. And because he has so much blood on his hands, he cannot build the temple in Jerusalem, right? And he is out one day and he sees a woman, and the woman is involved with one of his warriors, his mighty warriors is the phrase, Uri. And he essentially sends his general Yoav out to go to battle with Uri and to make sure that Uri doesn't come back. And really, it was my idea to begin with David King because, first of all, you're right, he is the most recognizable type. He's a North Jersey Jew in the moving and storage business, right? But, you know, a Republican, a Zionist, but also someone in my mind that kind of could come from the fiction that I grew up reading, which is Roth and Bellow. But out of his desire for a family, because the men of that generation, their family desires were in collapse. You know, David King's daughter doesn't really want to deal with him. I mean, she is a drug addict and it kind of runs away. And the family hates him because of her political, you know, differences.
She doesn't need televisions. She needs money for drugs.
Right. Or she just at least needs to know that her sort of NYU acquired socialism is something that he respects. And so what he does is he needs family. And he's a man because he accumulates, because he amasses, he says, oh, what about those cousins in Israel? And in a sense, like, you know, it takes that idea of family is not maybe what you have. It's sort of, it's the connections that you invent and you justify. And you say, oh, of course, him, he can be my replacement son. He can go to work for me. So he brings his cousin over who's just getting out of the IDF. And, you know, as this typical Israeli custom, you do your stint, your compulsory military service, and then you go for time abroad, except now this guy comes in and works as a mover, and then later as an eviction mover.
Now, this is hilarious. What is the daughter's name?
Tammy.
Yeah, and you just think, this Jew, mm-hmm. this David King, King mm-hmm. David, what am I going to name my daughter?
Right.
Tammy.
Tammy, yeah.
Tammy.
Right, right.
Yes. So, of course, she only comes to visit him once a year.
Absolutely.
Who named Tammy by King David would come and visit?
Right.
And all she wants is a check.
All she wants is, yeah.
But she is a little bit curious because these Israeli cousins mm-hmm. have come, well, first one and then another. One of these people who'll be called a cousin the way someone will be called an uncle right. who's not related.
Right.
You know, this is the family of aggregated guilt.
Right. It is, and it has this familiarity, but also this exoticism, which is to say, I hope, or I intended it as a representation of Israel itself. You know, these cousins, they don't act like Jews, in quotes, you know, in the sense of Ashkenaz, you know, European Jews that we know from television here, right? These are people who have, in the time that the family has sort of split from Europe, some came to the States, these others married Mizrahim, Eastern Jews, Arab Jews, and they developed that mentality. And Israel, in its lifetime, I mean, this is the 50th anniversary coming up of the occupation of the 67 war, and Israel really in that time has become this majority Mizrahi state. And you know, these are not people who are thinking about black and white images of the Holocaust. These are people who come from families that were kicked out of Arab countries in the mid 50s. And, you know, in the early 60s. And they grew up in homes with grandparents who spoke Arabic and feel a sort of mistrust for Arabs the way a brother would feel for a brother.
So in other words, in this book, Moving Kings, by my guest Joshua Cohen, the blending of ethnicities is the same as it is in America. No one is purely Jew or Arab anymore.
Right.
The blending of languages, Ivrit, mm-hmm. is no longer Hebrew.
No.
It's a language that's been inflected by all sorts of other Arabic languages.
And so then these two guys who come from a situation where their military service during the Gaza War was and before, was essentially to go into homes and take everything out of the homes and steal it, kick the family out to the street, and then call in a bulldozer to knock it down, they find themselves now in Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx, going into people's homes, taking everything out of it, kicking them to the curb, and going on.
Yes, and what we have to face is a perpetual irony as represented on a sign on a house facing foreclosure in Wakefield, Bronx, New York in 2012, a sign saying, "Let my people stay." Huh. Let my people go is the
Moses
prayer
yeah.
for slaves all over the world. When Israel was in Egypt's land,
right.
Let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand. Let my people go. And here we have, let my people stay. We're in a place of constant divestment. People being lured to buy houses that they can't stay in, who are facing goons. Israeli gangsters and goons, but people of all sorts of unfaceable disconnection, no career, and they're all working as strong arm men. People, blacks, mm-hmm. Puerto Ricans, Jews, they're all there to strong arm and muscle and beat the crap out of people who have nowhere to be.
Yeah.
And they themselves have nowhere to be.
The only place that they have to be is in the act of dispossession. That has been their training, and it has also, in a sense, been their it's the violence that's an expression of a lack of other opportunity. And one of the things that I really set myself up to do with this book is, how do I express, first of all, I wanted to write a novel about work, but the other thing was, how do I express that sense of futility in a way that is in a way that shows itself in its language and in the trajectories of sort of every character. My idea always was that, you know, you have a tragedy in Israel with this occupation, and you have this housing crisis here. And my idea was, you know, only on the page of fiction can these two things be seen not just to be metaphorically echoing each other, but they can actually seem to be linked.
And in this book, he's gone, King David King, from trucks that move things from one place to another, that to massive rearrangement and destruction on that small family scale, so that the Gaza war is being waged within the family and between members of the family from the two countries.
Yeah. And it's the mutual misunderstanding of what one wants. You know, a family, unlike a political situation, is in many ways, you know, unappealable. You can't choose who your parents are, and there's no situation in which, you know, peace negotiations or talks can be held that would fundamentally sever a relationship, at least in the world I grew up in. And it feels to me that to grow up with this inevitable sense of oppression and expectation, when the claws get into you and the roots get into you and you cannot take them out of your flesh without losing your flesh, this to me began to seem like the exact situation of 50 years of Israeli occupation in the West Bank.
Now, is this book, would you say, the heir of Roth and Bellow and the novelists who brought the Jewish novel to such prominence in American literature?
It's so difficult to wrestle with those ideas, because, you know, what was Israel from 48 on? It was, for American novelists, it was a magical place to come and refresh one's identity, right?
The external world, which we didn't go.
And it was a place where Jews had become normalized into these muscular, militant men. Growing up, that was not what Israel meant to me. That's also not my conception of Jewish history. I mean, you know, Zionism, in a sense, in my mind, is really the foremost example of a metaphor that became real. You know, in May of 48, you know, it's a historic date for everyone, not just Jews, because it's the day that a metaphor, a symbol became real, Zion, right? This proleptic idea of Zion, the ingathering of exiles, this thousands of years of tradition in which Zionism was a poetics is suddenly now being reified, concretized, made out of concrete barriers. Roads were carved out and people were kept behind lines. And it was that shift from the poetics to the reality that I think took a long time to set in for writers. And I wanted to sort of restore that clear-eyed sense of what Zion was, which is to say, it is not for us. It is not for this life.
So, Josh Cohen, in Moving Kings, like most of the book, it's about lovely ideas that collapsed into unfortunate realities. What is the reality of a family that is split apart but still wants to call itself a family, even if they never see each other?
Yeah.
What is it when the only time they say the Shema is when someone on the street says, "Did you say your prayers today?" and offers you the occasion? Why? Because you look like you might be a Jew. And you lie to this man, "Yes, I did say my prayers. I said the Shema." Mm-hmm. And eventually, forced, you say what you know. The Shema says that God is one. This isn't a prayer. This doesn't ask for anything, but it is the way a Jew makes contact with the Holy Spirit, blessed be He. It's like the zoning call, Shema Yisrael, mm-hmm. Hashem Eloheinu Hashem Echad. We've just made a connection.
Mm-hmm.
But no. How many generations of Shema? And so the connection is being forced now into an idea about Israel that not even Israel would want to participate in. Yes? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I believe so. I mean, I think, you know the people you know, and to speak for an entire country, you know, who can do that? But certainly among the drunk poets I know in Israel, that is their desire. You know, from my perspective, the world had felt so coarsened recently for reasons that everyone who could be listening already knows. And I felt that there was this aggressive desire or almost like a compulsion. Someone was telling me, write about work. Get down into the ground, a blood and soil kind of thing. And there's this idea, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. Eretz is the word for land. And then there's the other word for land, which is Adama, which is soil and earth. And I felt that all of these populisms, I'm trying to avoid saying words like right-wing populism, I'm trying to avoid saying words like ethno-nationalism, but they're unavoidable. It just felt that it was such an assault on what I as a writer had always loved. I wanted to exercise that free fantasy and not be always called to account for labor for which I'm not responsible, you know, or hatreds for which I'm not responsible. And with this book, I decided that I wanted to go into that spirit that says, oh, you're a writer? Great. You know, like, put in the hours, put in the work, put in the sweat. Because that is what built this country. That is what built the country that defends you. That is what built the country that safeguards your spiritual inheritance. And so a lot of the thinking of this book was actually how do I aggress against certain very natural novelistic instincts, because I felt the time in which I was writing aggressed against them to such a degree that the only way that I could actually feel in some way functional was to examine how an indulgence of these pretty prehistoric principles panned out, where they stranded you, and where they stranded you is essentially homeless. Where they strand you is there's a man who keeps all of your possessions in his own place, and you don't have access to it. How it ends is a man who lives out in the outer boroughs, a black man who's a Vietnam veteran, is dispossessed and put on the street and dies in a subway tunnel.
Wow, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Joshua Cohn about his new novel, Moving Kings. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joshua Cohn about his latest book, Moving Kings, a story that boldly puts two crises on equal footing, the Middle East and the American housing shortage for people of color. Now, the father of the family, David King, comes from, what, the 1950s or 60s?
50s, yeah.
And we're watching the world change. So, you know, cousins who come over from Israel who are made into heirs and sons, they don't know how to go to an American celebration at the end of a day of fast. He has to be given a suit. It doesn't fit him, but it's better than the sweatshirt, the hoodie he would have worn otherwise. And, you know, the sister, cousin, who says, why should I care about him? They there in Israel don't care about me. What's our connection?
Mm-hmm.
And they can't locate their connection until they discover that they both like to drink a lot. They're both as drunk as one another at the celebration.
And they're both dependent on the same source of money.
Yes.
Yeah. Well.
This father gives money.
Right.
He makes one of them work. He makes the other play.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He,
and one of the... one of the things that I think is most puzzling to Israeli soldiers who come over is this idea of storage, right? You earn money, you buy something. Then when you have too many things, you then pay money to rent space to put the thing in, and you never see it, you know? So you're paying money every month so that the things that you work to buy can't be used, right? And you have almost visitation rights with your past. And a lot of these ideas of Israel are that same concept. It's a storage facility for ideas of Jewish continuity, for ideas of Jewish aesthetics, for ideas of Jewish poetics. It's this. It is a vast storage locker that that you can visit, but it's not habitable.
Why, so many people are going to have trouble with this definition, Josh.
Sure, but look, I say this as someone who grew up religiously, and I say this also as someone who has great love for the country.
Who spent time there?
A lot of time there. Yeah, very much so. And believe me, I've already gotten the response from Israeli family. But it's not a question even of just the criticizing through love, which obviously through this book is something I've learned through my family. You know, when you love someone, you say you're ugly. You know, because you know there's an aggression that is the coding of love, the encryption of love, because otherwise we wouldn't trust sincerity. We've never trusted sincerity because the world hasn't dealt sincerely with us. And so the ultimate construction, though, of within the book is it's a question of not a relationship with Israel, right? I hope the book is not parochial in that way. It's about a relationship with a dream or with a projection. And then what happens when the reality shows up on your doorstep, and everything collapses.
But they're all dispossessed. They're all speaking in the languages of dispossession, of, you know, pop and rap, all kinds of things that stand for dream riches.
Yes.
And what's terribly sad is that by the end of this novel, there's no natural language for anyone to speak. All they have is the possibility of Molotov cocktails, of bombs, that they are, you know, just a moving company, but there they are. They're fighting a full-fledged war to make a person a zero.
Right. And so a lot of the struggle in this book, as well as the struggle of writing this book, was to show that that language is the thing that keeps all of these truly animal instincts at bay, the acquisitive instinct, the buying instinct, the taking someone else, the despoiling instinct.
So, in other words, you're saying that not only was there the dream of Israel, there was the dream of language. There was a dream of fiction or poetry that would rescue us from the animal instinct, and
absolutely,
that it fails to. Well, then why write a novel? How write a novel? Can you write a novel?
Right. I mean, this to me is my Shema. This to me is my creed. You know, it's not a prayer in the sense of beseeching someone, please God, let novels be relevant. Please God, let novels mean something. No, it's a recitation saying, you know, Shema Yisrael Adonai Echad. Like, hero Israel, this is a novel, and it is yours. I was watching the Gaza War that summer, and then watching everyone in New York being, you know, thrown out of their houses in East New York, and you know, movers crossing picket lines and people trying to say, let these people stay in the house. You know, it wasn't just that. It was the daily practice of writing this book and thinking it through was the greatest defense against a time that seemed more arrayed against the life of the mind and the life of the imagination than any in my memory.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me because I found the book wonderful reading, fascinating. And it's, you know, because the characters are movers, This book moves very rapidly.
Yes.
They've been taught to move things quickly, and so flashbacks occur in a second, and we're back in the present again before we know it. There's enormous facility, virtuosity, in making things happen in this book and in blowing things up.
Okay.
I took the title, as soon as I got the book, Moving Kings, I thought, when do you move kings? You move kings during the end game. You keep moving them and moving them and moving them until there's either defeat or you say you can't play anymore. That's what moving kings meant to me.
Yeah, a moving king is not a king. A king doesn't move for anyone.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it certainly has the, you know, the chess aspect, but I also mean it in a sense of how many kings of Israel are always depicted. You know, the kings of Israel that just sat in Israel aren't really written about. It's always the kings on the run. And that to me is the essence of the title. And when you look back to the myths of the kings, you call them the chronicles, the histories, or the myths of the kings, they were the last real leaders that were brought down by family. Here were brought down by fellow professionals, you know, by fellow civil servants, right? This is the idea that you lose your kingdom because of your son. You lose your kingdom because of your son-in-law. You lose the kingdom because of your brother. And that element of the biblical kings, to me, has great, great resonance and metaphoric truth in our personal lives today, not in our governance, but in our relationship, in our family relationships. And I wanted to write that sort of biblical saga. I wanted to write that mythic saga, and it had to be done in North Jersey.
I've been talking with Joshua Cohen, author of Moving Kings, published by Random House. Josh, thank you for joining me. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Moving Kings at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Jim Gower is our guest.